Bon, qu'est-ce que l'on pense? Et qu'est-ce que l'on pense? Qu'est-ce que l'on pense?
Sorry. Yeah,
oh, sorry, that it worked.
Is that a special ring that you wear?
Yeah, he gave me.
Where do you, oh, from India.
From India, yeah, it's five metals. It's supposed to be very auspicious.
Yes. It looked like it was from India. And it touches, the Indian stones have no back to it.
Yeah.
And it touches the skin itself. Mm-hmm. So India is such an amazing place. Raise your hand if you've been to India. Yes, even you. Yes. Yes?
No.
No. You? Yes?
You.
Yeah. No. Not yet. Some other. Have you been to India?
No.
Yes. It's such an amazing place because it gives you such deep faith in God, because it's so chaotic. You can't imagine it going on unless there's some higher power working. Everything goes on at once. You have some the major road on it, you know, with the main road from Delhi to the Taj Mahal, you know, where all the tourists go.
The best road in India.
The best road in India, and there's cars on it, modern cars. There are these huge trucks that are piled much, much too high and much too long with goods. And then there's camels pulling carts and people on their rickshaws and carts being pulled by bulls. And they're all going at different speeds on the same road. And then there's always someone who wants to go the opposite, on the wrong side of the road too. And then there's buses and everyone's just honking at each other. I remember one time I went to... I went high into the Himalayan mountains one summer because I was staying in Vrindavan, and it was very, very, very hot. So myself and my son went into the Himalayan mountains, and the road that the Himalayan mountains are very high, right? And there's these more very thin roads, maybe from here to there, and it's double traffic. And it's definitely not enough room for two buses or cars to go on. And the drivers are so religious that when they go around a blind turn, instead of looking or slowing down, they pray. And then you look down on the side of the road, and there's huge drops of like hundreds and hundreds of feet. And you see, and sometimes you see a bus down there, you know, that's already falling over. And it's so amazing place, but it's so deeply spiritual on the other hand. And you go to a place like Vrindavan, and it's so unique. More than I remember my first visit to Vrindavan, which was, I think, 1974. I remember the first time I was leaving Vrindavan in 1974. And I remember, you know, I spent my days there, and it was very nice. And then I got on a bus with some other Hare Krishna devotees, and it was time to leave. And, you know, I packed the things. And suddenly the bus started pulling out, and I thought, oh no, what am I doing? And that happened. I'd come to Vrindavan or Mayapur, another very holy place. And every time I would be leaving, that without, very spontaneously, I would be thinking, what am I doing? Why am I leaving? Because the very place has a spiritual potency. And spiritual potency, just like when you come, if you're living in Harish or living somewhere in the countryside that's peaceful, when you come to Tel Aviv or any big city, there's an energy, passion, that, you know, it just moves everything and it feels completely different. So similarly in Vrindavan, there is an energy that feels completely different from not only Tel Aviv, but it feels completely different from any other holy place as well. In the Himalayan mountains, there is some. When you go high into the Himalayan mountains, or go to Rishikesh or Haridwar, you've been. No. Yes. Very, very peaceful and very, very deep. But Vrindavan has something so unique, a sweetness that's so unique, just in the atmosphere, and it's extremely thick in the atmosphere. I don't know if as soon as you got there you experienced it, or you have to be there for a while, or you have to relax. When you were there, did you, as soon as you walked into Vrindavan, did you feel that it was a special place?
No.
No. After you were there for a little while?
Yes.
Yes. It sort of seeps in through your pores. And the reason why it is a special place and why it has this incredibly unique sweetness is that on that very land, Krishna and his dearest devotees, in Hare Krishna language, they perform their pastimes, their activities there. And the activities of Krishna are very special, because when one thinks of the absolute truth or the supreme being or you can say God or whatever, one really doesn't have a clear conception of what this all-pervasive spiritual reality is. Some people, depending upon the spiritual path, they perceive the absolute truth in one way and others perceive it in another way. But Vrindavan is especially unique because a very specific manifestation of the absolute truth had performed activities there. There is one verse in Sanskrit in the Srimad Bhagavatam: Vedanti tatva vidas tatvam yas gyanam adayam brahmeti paramatmakti bhagavaniti sabhyate. And this means that when learned persons describe the absolute truth, there may be many different learned persons and they may describe the absolute truth differently, but there is only one absolute truth, and the Sanskrit word is adhvaya gyan, which means it is non-dual. There are not two things in it. It is just one. But yet, even though there is one absolute truth, still there are different ways of perceiving that absolute truth. And if one takes to the path of Advaita Gyan or Jnana Yoga or meditation and renunciation, then one will perceive the absolute truth as everything, that there is nothing separate from it. And indeed, that is true, because by definition, the absolute truth is that substance that nothing is separate from, otherwise it wouldn't be absolute. Maybe am I speaking too fast, or because I can't speak Hebrew, unfortunately.
Can you repeat the last?
If I could remember it, I could. What did I say? I don't remember where I was up to.
Said that there was any.
Yes.
One absolute truth. Pervasive.
Yes, by definition, if there was something outside of or external to the absolute truth, then the absolute truth wouldn't be all-inclusive, it wouldn't be absolute. So this is one realization that one gets, that one can get through very, very, very deep meditation and renunciation of ultimately one's identification with the body as oneself. and one begins to perceive the spiritual nature of oneself, and then identifying with everything in existence, and one's self being part of that absolute. So that's through the process of jnana yoga. Jnana means knowledge, and yoga means the process of connecting through knowledge, connecting to the absolute truth. So Brahmeti, Paramatmeti, Bhagavaneti Sabyate. So if one takes to the path of jnana yoga and renunciation, then one perceives the absolute truth as Brahman, or all pervading. And out of the different religious and spiritual paths in the world, even though they appear different, regardless of where they are, what country they are practiced in, they really bring one to one out of these different levels of that one absolute truth. And maybe the different religions fight with each other about which one is the one, but there's only one absolute truth, and there are different perceptions of it according to the path one takes. So the second path is Brahman, or the everythingness of existence, the oneness of everything in existence. And then more inclusive than that even is the path of yoga, and that brings one to understand that in everyone's heart, in everything, whether it's animate or inanimate, that absolute truth is situated. And the yogis, through their specific process of Ashtanga yoga, which has Ashtanga, eight parts, starting with the yam, niyam, the rules and regulations, you should do this, you can't do that. Because we can't expect to realize something very, very subtle without adjusting our own consciousness and making our consciousness subtle. So there's rules and regulations in yoga. Yam, niyam. Then the third step is asan, which is generally what people think of as yoga, which is, you know, all the sitting postures and I can't do any of them anymore. But all of them, all the different thousands of sitting postures and trying to make one's consciousness, to remove ignorance from every part of one's body. Does anyone practice? Yes? Especially Iyengar yoga, and they have the Ashtanga yoga. There's another guru of that, all coming from that, Krishnamacharya, who is in the Ramanuja Sampradaya, actually a Vaishnava. You know that at the end of his life, that Krishnamacharya, you know Krishnamacharya? He lived to be over 100, and he would just chant japa at the end of his life. Huh?
Unlike his son.
Iyengar. No.
No. Or,
yes, the Desakacharya. Yeah. So Iyengar married Krishnamacharya's his older sister married Krishnamacharya. So they somehow ended up in their ashram. But in any case, there's the asana, and after one practices the asanas and becomes perfectly healthy by doing that and conscious, then one begins pranayama, or the breathing exercises, by breathing is very, very powerful, because the mind is connected to breath. And by the breathing exercises, not only the body becomes filled with oxygen, but the mind becomes very still. And then after the pranayama process, which is the fourth step, then there's pratyahara, or withdrawing the mind because it's peaceful and still. Usually our minds are external to everything and running here and there and jumping and moving. So by this mechanical process of yoga, one can have incredible realizations but it's extremely difficult if one does it right. Mm-hmm. So pratyahara means the withdrawal of the mind from the external and focusing it inward. And then, because you've already have the ability to move the life airs, you move it through the different chakras, and dharan, dhyan, increasing intensities of ability of focusing in meditation, and ultimately one perceives in the heart the super soul, and one can be enwrapped in meditation upon this supreme being living who is situated within the heart along with the individual soul. There's the individual soul, that soul that is supplying consciousness to the body, to each and every one of us, because in the Bhagavad Gita and all these philosophies, whether it's that bring us to the absolute truth, make a clear distinction between the soul or the self, who I am, and the body, because the body is temporarily, I feel it as me, but if you think you are your body, and you remember when you were 3 years old, and you had a completely different body, and that was you, you felt it was you, and when you were 30 years old, some of you may not be there yet, but it will happen, or you know, you're that, you think you're that body. And then when you're 45 years old, you think you're that body. And when you're 59 years old almost, then you think you're that body. So if you're your body, which body are you? The one that's 3, or the one that's 16, or the one that's 20, or 30, or 40? But if one thinks deeply about it, one can at least theoretically understand that the body is not me, because I change my body continuously from, as Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita, komanam, jovanam, jara, from boyhood or girlhood to youth to old age. But there's some continuity of identity that doesn't change. The body changes, and when you show, you know, when you see someone who knew you when you were a child, and you see them after 30 years, and they say, "Oh, you've changed so much." But yes, the body is completely changed, but I'm the same person. I'm the same person. So there's something that doesn't change, and the something that doesn't change never changes, actually. That sense of identity, of existence, I am, that we would say, or ego, or sense of existence, a sense of self, that never changes, and it's eternal. So it is that soul, that eternal soul, that is supplying consciousness. The symptom of the soul is consciousness. So it is the soul that supplies consciousness to the body. And the exact moment when the soul leaves the body is matter. Consciousness is gone, the life is gone, and it's matter. Dead matter, we say dead matter, but it's matter is always dead. There's no life in it. But it is the soul, just like the driver gets in the car, or the computer programmer gets behind the machine and pushes the button, and the thing boots up, or the car turns over. But the life isn't in the machine. The life is in that person who turns the key or pushes the button. So similarly, the life isn't the body any more than the life is the car or the computer, but the life is within it, the soul, and that soul is eternal. So within every body, there is both a soul and a super soul. Super soul means the supreme soul, and the individual soul, that's each and every one of us. So through yoga, the individual soul, through increasingly intense processes of of meditation, going from dharan, by going through all the steps of the Ashtanga Yoga, dharan, dhyan, and samadhi, then samadhi is fixed in consciousness, equally fixed consciousness on the Supersoul, and a full meditation upon that Supreme Being in the heart. And that's called the process of yoga, and that's Paramatma realization. So it's Brahmeti, Paramatmeti. That means how Krishna, how the Absolute Truth is everything, and then how it is everything as the Paramatma, as the Supersoul. And one attains that realization through yoga. And the third of the levels is called Bhagavan. There's one Absolute Truth, three different levels of appreciating it depending upon the process that one uses of attainment, one attains one or another of the realizations. And the third realization, through bhakti or devotion, then one understands the Absolute Truth as a person, a supreme person. Not a person like each and every one of us. We're all, what does it mean to be a person? What's something?
I have desires.
You have desires, yes. Individual characteristics. What else?
Ambitions.
I'm sorry.
Ambitions. Yeah, you were thinking of something else. I caught you. But there's individuality. So when it's very hard for us, not very hard, it's impossible for us to conceive of the Absolute Truth as a person, because, for instance, I'm sitting here. And if I'm sitting here, a person is here. That means I'm not sitting there. So a person, personality, from the material point of view, using the material intelligence, the finite intelligence, it appears to be a limitation on the Absolute Truth. But the Absolute Truth isn't limited by our material perception. The Absolute Truth is inconceivable, even though he's a person. So he's unlimited, but yet has a form. And yet has these other aspects of Paramatma as the Supersoul and as the all-pervading. But yet, this third aspect of Bhagavan is a person, a supreme person, an all-powerful person. But yet, an unlimited person. And one name for that understanding of the Absolute Truth of Bhagavan is Krishna. And Krishna literally means, there's many meanings, but the one we are most fond of is all attractive. Because practically by definition, that person possesses to an unlimited degree everything that is attractive within this world and every world to an unlimited degree. So Krishna comes, Bhagavan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as we usually say, Bhagavan, or this aspect of the Absolute Truth, he comes to Vrindavan. And he performs activities that are meant to increase ecstasy. He performs different pastimes, activities, with his dearest devotees. An example would be, say there's the government, there's the king, and then there's the person who's the king. So most people don't get to see the king. But they're aware of the government, and the government pervades the kingdom. It's, you know, its influence is everywhere in the kingdom, and there's no place where the government's energy or power or potency or influence isn't. In the prison and in the lives of the citizens and the markets and this and that, the government, it's working. So that's like understanding the absolute truth as Brahman, who's everything and everywhere. But behind that, there is the officer, the person who holds the post, and the post makes him the king. And that king, he holds a scepter, he wears a crown, he sits on his throne, and when everyone deals with him, they're very reverential, they call him sire and or your majesty or something like that, and all the dealings are very official. And he has to listen to everyone's complaints, and everyone, when they come before him, they have to say nice things to him, otherwise it's off with his head, you know. So everyone's very polite to the king and very respectful, and there's always fear when you're dealing with a king. So that's like dealing with the Paramatma, or you can say the religious concept of God. You know, people come to the king, they say, "My dear sir, you're the greatest king in the world, please, but I have this problem, do this, do this, do this." So he knows that any time there's praise, after that it's going to be the request. But yet, that king who sits on the throne is also a person. And few people get to serve the king, even as the king. There's a few messengers and intimate members of the court. But there's some times when the king just goes into the private parts of his palace. He relaxes with his family. Sometimes his young son, he'll get down on all four legs, and his young son will get on his back and go, you know, like that. "Come on, giddy up, giddy up, giddy up." And sometimes his young son will have a fight with him, and he'll go, you know, like this to his father, the king, and then the father goes down on the ground. This, because the dealings in the private palace, it's the same person who's the king and who's the government, but this is the most intimate dealings. And if you're in the court and the king is on the throne and someone says, "Get down on all your four legs," and, you know, and he starts whacking the king over here like the son does, no, it's completely inappropriate. Why? Because the relationship, the depth of the relationship, the love just isn't there. The reverence is there in the court, but the love isn't there. So the dealings with the person who's the king in the private parts of the palace are very, very, very different. They're the most trusted, intimate persons and the most loving persons. They have the deepest relationship with the king. It's the same person who's the king, who's the government, who's the person in the back part of the palace. But only the most intimate, loving, and trusted persons are allowed in the private quarters of the king. Otherwise, it's too confusing. What's this? I thought the king was so powerful, and his wife's yelling at him. What's going on? So the king, in his private palaces and his most intimate pastimes, that is the absolute truth in Vrindavan. And because the dominance of the atmosphere in Vrindavan is love of the most intense, trusted, spiritual kind. What?
Just when
I'm
asking a question.
Yeah, okay. Just when I was about to make the strongest point. What was it again? What were we talking about? Something about Vrindavan? Oh, yeah. And the most intimate thing. And that's why Vrindavan has its sweetness, the special sweetness. Again, you can go to Somat, you can go to the top of the Himalayan mountains, to Badrinath and to Gangotri and to Yamunotri and Kedarnath. And there's such incredible depth of peace there that it's shocking, practically. But you'll never find a place as sweet as Vrindavan, because that's the most intimate place where Krishna has his pastimes with the most trusted devotees, where he can take off his robes and stop listening to everyone's prayers all the time. Give me this and give me that and give me that, and you are so wonderful, you're so great, but please, I have a problem with my knee, fix it, and you're so wonderful, but my daughter has to pass her medical school exams, please do this. So he can get away from all that and just exchange love with people who don't want anything but just love him. Love is the dominant part of Vrindavan. So to get to that place, it's only bhakti yoga, the devotional service, as Prabhupada, our spiritual master, translated bhakti, devotion and service, loving service. So that process of devotional service, in one sense, it's the easiest. In another sense, it's the most difficult. It's easiest in the sense you don't have to be a great renunciant, and you don't have to renounce the world. You don't have to sit in yoga postures for hundreds of years in the middle of the forest. But what you do have to do is chant Hare Krishna, very, very simple in one sense, but one has to eventually fall in love with Krishna. So it's easiest to do in one sense, and it's most appealing in that same sense, because everyone is looking for love. We're looking usually in the wrong place, but we're looking for love because we know that's what will satisfy us. But the thing that makes it difficult is we have to give up our selfishness and our self-centeredness, and we can't do it all at once. So we do it slowly and gradually, but that's the part that makes it difficult. We have to give up our false sense of being the center of existence, because obviously that's illusion. Obviously, each individual is the center of existence, obviously not. But that's bhakti yoga. And we chant Hare Krishna, and it happens very naturally. What? Any questions? Thank you very much. Questions or comments? Yes.
You said you have to fall in love with Krishna.
If you want to get to Vrindavan.
Yeah.
And that's what bhakti yoga is in the process.
Yeah, I understand.
Yes.
So, you know, until now, if I had a girlfriend, so I wanted to show her my love, you know, I used to buy her, I don't know, present, or, you know, say I love you, or, you know, the natural things that I know what to do.
Yeah.
So when you say, you know, love Krishna, so how can I show him my love?
Well, I can buy him a present, I could say I love you. let it be natural. But don't be a hypocrite. don't lie. If you say I love you and then just using that to exploit your girlfriend, and then eventually you'll get into trouble.
I know.
So just take it slowly and be natural. Because Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Patram Pushpam Palam Toyam Yoman Bhakti Prayasati Taraham Bhakti Paritam Asnami Paratapmana, that he makes this point, if you love me, what do I want from you? Just give me a leaf, a fruit, some flower, some water, but Bhakti Paritam, let it be done with devotion. Whatever you give it, something simple even, but let it be done with devotion. In other words, devotion doesn't mean anything extremely esoteric, but it means a sincere desire to please another. So, and I've been coming more and more to the conclusion that so much simply rests on sincerity. Yeah, just a simple attempt that's sincere will take us quite far.
But again, that leads me to the question that I ask you, I always ask you, I think.
Yes.
Is when I kind of force myself, you know, because I know that this is how I'm supposed to do it. But then you say, okay, be sincerely. So, you know, I'm trapped because...
Why?
Because, okay, you say be sincere, be, you know, you really have to feel if you...
But according to him, not that you wait until you're fully sincere, because if you wait till you're fully sincere, you never take any steps. But with whatever sincerity you have, act on that platform right now.
And at the same time, try to take it.
Yeah, go.
Higher.
Yeah, well, take means chant Hare Krishna, you know, help the devotees, do your part, and bring Krishna present now and then, whenever you can, and try to act in such a way that you'll be pleasing. So, how to do that? That takes some time to learn. Just like, if you like to eat meat, and then you think, I like this, so I'm going to give it to Krishna. But you have to learn that's not what will please Krishna. He doesn't like that kind of killing. So there is some knowledge that you need to know. So there's books that you can read and study, the Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, especially the Bhagavad Gita, and learn the art of Krishna consciousness, acting sincerely to please Krishna. Take some, say if you want to serve the king, going back to our king example. So you have to find out about him, what he likes, what he doesn't like, because he's a person. So find out what Krishna likes, what he doesn't like, give him what he likes. And if you think that, what am I going to do? This supreme person has everything. Everything is his. So what can I give him? So Prabhupada used to tell the example that if there is a very wealthy man, if you give his son something, his child something, then you please him very easily. Otherwise, what can you give him? You'll give him a Rolls Royce or something. He's got 60 already. So you find those who love Krishna more than you, and you help them a bit, and then Krishna becomes pleased. That's another way to look at it. I don't mean to be evasive when by telling you step by step, sincerely. But there is a whole process, and you should learn it. But you still have to go step by step. Just can't do it all at once. At least that's what I've seen. It's possible theoretically, but most of us take go gradually. But chant Hare Krishna, be happy, and find out from the devotees how to progress, how to become a devotee. Any other? Yeah.
What do you mean by you get the devotee power?
Into?
Power. You said that if you you're not sincere with your feelings to Krishna, you say Ravi.
Oh. No, I meant it on the other side. If you have a girlfriend, he was talking about his girlfriend, and he says, "I love you," but he doesn't really love her, and he has four more girlfriends on the side. Then you get into deep trouble when she finds out. So similarly, what I meant is that. There's the sound of the city, isn't it?
The sound of the world.
What does that mean? Just nothing specific, just fire engine or something. It's also the sound of New York, by the way.
It's probably the Prime Minister in
there. No, I don't think so. I don't think he's going to be moving like that. So what I meant to say is, when you have deep, deep love, then you say, "I love you." Before you have deep love, you can say, perhaps, "I wish to love you. I have affection for you. I want to please you." So you don't have to try and flatter Krishna. Or anyone, you just be honest and speak from the platform of what your own realization. Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
And what do you mean by you said be happy?
Yeah. If you're getting on an elevator and there's 100 floors in the building and you've pressed the 100th button and the elevator is moving. So don't lament that you're on the second floor only now, or the third floor, or the fourth floor. You may actually be only on the level of the third floor, but if you're on the elevator seriously, it's just a matter of time before you're up to the top. So you can be happy, even though you're not at the level that you ultimately would like. So you could be happy knowing that you're in the right place, and that again, it's just a matter of time. Something like that.
When you talk about the intimate nature of Krishna and the person.
Yes.
And as a person, he has attributes.
Yes, quality, specific.
People do.
Yes.
What is the secret to discovering the attributes?
There's books that describe them. There's in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which Prabhupada translated as the Nectar of Devotion, there's a listing of 64 attributes of Krishna, for example. So.
Sometimes you read books or you come across descriptions or whatever, it's not the same as obviously having
right.
The person in front of you and discovering the attributes for yourself.
Yes, but say if, let's go back to our example of the king, that there he is, the official king, and then someone who you meet knows the king in his private quarters, and he tells you, actually, he's a very generous man, and he's really kind and really compassionate, and he's really funny too. You know, he jokes all the time, and he speaks 23 languages, and he's a genius.
You can put any question to him about anything and he'll answer it. So before you actually will meet the king, you hear about his qualities. And though it's not exactly the same as experiencing them for yourself, they will attract you to him, to this person. So there is something to be said for just hearing about them, not as a substitute for realizing them, but a natural step towards realizing them. And how do you... So let's take that natural step. So you discover that you're very attracted to deal with this king because you've never heard of anyone quite like him. So gradually you move sort of closer into the inner circle, and the king starts noticing, hey, there's this person here, this new person. So he doesn't immediately show him everything, but as he moves closer to actually intimate relationship with the king, as he develops his loving relationship with the king, as he's more trustworthy and shows himself as trustworthy and sincere in his relationship with the king, then the king naturally shows him as who he, you know, who he really is. Yeah. So there's two things going on simultaneously. One is our attempt to get closer and to become qualified to get closer. And that's our business, so to speak. But then there's Krishna's moving towards us. And that's what it ultimately takes for us to really realize his qualities and through personal experience. It takes him moving closer to us. But if we just sit back and, you know, I'll believe he has these qualities when he shows them to me, then he's, because he's a person, then he's going to say, well, you just wait out there for some time and we'll take care of you later. But if we do our part, then he will naturally do his part.
He'll move towards us in a sense because we're part of him.
Yeah, there's a natural loving relationship, but now we've turned our back on him and imagine ourselves as the center. We're all imagining ourselves as kings, the king of the whole thing. And it's obviously not true, but in our illusion, we think we're so important and I'm the center of everything, and how dare this one talk to me like this, and how dare this one did this, and this one likes me. That's proof that he's so intelligent. you know, we're just imagining. The whole thing is centered around me. So naturally, as we move to understand that there is the king and it's not me, then naturally, because we have a natural relationship with him, as you said exactly, that we're his part. We're part of him. Like a child. So naturally he wants to give us everything because it's such a natural loving relationship. It's natural. Krishna consciousness is natural. But I think your questions are all coming from quite a good understanding of what's going on with your comments. Yes?
I tried to stop myself from asking. But you said that...
But you didn't succeed. Obviously. If you would have warned me, I would have helped you.
But you said that the mood of Vrindavan is the sweetness. But
yes.
I was wondering what is supposed to be the mood of Puri.
Of Puri. There's three special dhams, or holy places. There's Jagannath Puri, there's Vrindavan and Mayapur. The mood of Puri is separation, missing the sweetness, which has its own flavor of sweetness, and in some ways even more intense than the sweetness itself.
You remember what you told me about Puri?
What?
It's the place you enter and just can't leave.
It just, yeah. 2 days ago he told me, yeah. You must go to Puri. When you leave this place, you say, what am I doing? Why am I leaving? That's exactly what you said.
Really?
Now.
You probably have some relationship with that place. Of what?
Mayapur.
It's in the Mayapur is there's two moods of Mayapur. Do you know anything about Mayapur at this point? But it's meeting, it's especially with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So I'll mention people that you don't know, so it'll be difficult. But yeah, okay. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and all the devotees had so much love for Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and they used to chant Krishna's names because Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is Krishna, but in the mood of a devotee. So he would chant Krishna's names every night with the other associates, and the whole place, the whole atmosphere would be surcharged with incredible ecstasy of remembrance of Krishna, just incredible ecstasy. They would be crying tears like the Ganga flowing from everyone's eyes. They would be falling to the ground in ecstasy and crying and chanting Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. So that's one mood of the spiritual world has entered and everyone is so happy. And then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu leaves and takes sannyas, and then everyone just misses him completely. And then they go to Jagannath Puri to see him. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mood in Jagannath Puri is missing Vrindavan. And Vrindavan has the sweetness of Radha and Krishna's pastimes. So in Mayapur, if you enter it very deeply into the mood, you end up in Vrindavan. Yeah, like that. Because you start understanding the ecstasy that Mahaprabhu and his associates are experiencing, and that has to do with Radha and Krishna. So you end up in Vrindavan. Is that okay? Any other questions or comments? You like Jagannath Puri?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really happy place, isn't it?
It's amazing. I was with my sister as well, and we actually forced ourselves to buy a ticket to continue the trip, otherwise we would stuck in Jagannath for the rest of the trip.
From
the pieces, you have something grabs you out of it.
Yeah.
But
we were so close and we didn't go.
Next time.
But they haven't been going to open the temple, probably.
Huh?
They had a discussion if to open the temple for
foreigners.
They were supposed to do a meeting on December.
They won't. But when I was in Jagannath Puri one time, it's a very magical place. All these three holy places, they are like magic in their way. You know, all these little miraculous little events always occur. And yeah. Anyway. Any more questions or comments?
I have a question.
Yes.
There are many forms of Krishna, many channels to reach Krishna.
Channels? What do you mean?
I mean, when you worship Krishna, you can... devotees worship the Lord Chaitanya, they worship Krishna in his very personal form, and people worship
and Jagannath.
Radha. What is the best, as I said, channel to reach Krishna personally? should you worship all of them, give a little bit to each and every one, or is it according to my personal what is the suggested method?
Chanting Hare Krishna.
But you have to focus on a form. You have to focus on an image.
See, there's certain things that are common that everyone should do, and then there's certain things that come through your own individuality. And in the beginning, while you're forming the basis of your Krishna consciousness, the foundation, you shouldn't emphasize the individuality as much as just doing the basic things. And then later on, naturally, you develop a more of a taste for something. But if you just go on your taste in the beginning, then you'll head out and away from the basic path, and it won't work ultimately. So you should just, again, excuse me for saying it, but step by step, you know, it happens. Because it's, you know, and also your tastes change. Just like when you were young, you liked one kind of thing, and then, you know, 5 years later, you like something else. So you can't fully take your tastes completely as if they're everything until you mature. But so therefore, not that we don't, you know, because you're not a kid anymore either.
Yeah, and there's always the danger of becoming impersonalist, because there's no way.
No, but the point I was going to make is that therefore, if we have a desire to do something, we find those who know us spiritually and who we trust, and we don't just act based on what I feel, but we, you know, we have to find trusted others to get advice from. Yeah, that's really the balancing point in it, it seems to me. So it's very, very fortunate if we have those who we trust that are more, you know, wise and mature and experienced, that we can ask questions to. It's very fortunate. Otherwise, you have to learn everything the hard way, by mistakes and trying this and banging your head again and again.
When you say that Krishna is everything that's attractive to us.
Yes.
So, in a sense, as we approximate towards Krishna, does that, I mean, that would mean that, in a sense, we become more attracted to ourselves? Because we approximate to Him.
Well, as we become purified, which is, I'm just translating it into, I guess, my language, or Hare Krishna language, as we become more purified, then the nasty parts of ourself are dropped, and the more, you could say, good or godly parts of ourself are developed. And yes, then we become more attractive to ourself. You know, the Bhagavatam actually explains this. Yes, yes, the bhakti of Bhagavata Kinshina. That in one who becomes a lover of Krishna, a devotee, then naturally all the good qualities begin to develop. And because we are by nature wonderful, each and every one of us, because we're souls, we're eternal, you know, we're part of Krishna, and this is perhaps what you were implied by what you're saying, because we're part of Krishna, we have wonderful qualities. But now, because we've turned from our relationship with Krishna and we think of ourselves as center, all the good qualities that we know are in us, we all inherently know that we're good and wonderful, but those are covered. So as we
chant and follow the devotional process, those coverings go away, and like a lotus flower, the godly qualities develop as our relationship with Krishna develops. Shraya Karayava Chandrika Vataranam. Yeah. So I translated a little, but I think, that's a natural byproduct of developing love for Krishna, as opposed to what one is striving for, to have good qualities. It comes naturally when you develop love for Krishna. If you make love for Krishna your goal, then a natural byproduct of that is that you become very wonderful yourself. But the goal isn't to become wonderful yourself, the goal is to love Krishna. Any other questions or comments?
Yes.
Yes.
The beginning of chapter 7, I don't remember the exact phrase, but it says that...
of Bhagavad Gita.
Yes. That only few know about Krishna, and only one in a million really get to know him. So what chance do we have?
Serious question.
Yeah, I know.
Sometimes it feels like not very much. But Krishna is kind. From what I've seen is that once you want to get to Krishna, he's got you in a sense, and it's just a matter of time. But it will take its time until you develop the qualification that will allow you to be with Krishna. So that's the struggle of spiritual life. You know, trying to get rid of this covering and this material desire which covers the thing, the heart, that disallows us from being a trusted member of the inner court. So struggling with the lower self, so to speak, is the struggle of spiritual life. So when that verse of the Bhagavad Gita explains that out of thousands of people even desire liberation, and then out of those thousands hardly one knows me in truth, so that's really speaking about the common people in this world, because the common people, they just have material desires, basically. But we want to be, even though we may have material desires, it's not that we want to have them. We want to be a pure devotee of Krishna, but we can't quite do it yet. But if the desire is right, then it's really again just a matter of time. And every time, you know, I can't remember, someone told me this, or I read it somewhere, that sometimes when you know, you're going along the path and it seems so far away, and you know, what hope do I have? So sometimes when you want to feel humble, you look forward. And when you want to feel somewhat reassured that you've come a long way, you look back. So I think you've come a long way, right? So I think the balance of the two is required. Sometimes we have to look forward so then we become humble of heart, and then we make our sincere attempt, and that attracts some mercy towards us. And then when that becomes a little too much, to always think that you know so far to go, and you get discouraged, you have to look back a little bit and see that you've come a long way, and how wonderful it is, and it's quite rare in and of itself. So what hope do we have? Which was actually your question. I didn't. Again, let me think. When I think of my hope, that's the only way, because it's hard to answer a question, what hope do we have? Because I don't know what hope we have, You only have to ask everyone individually, you know, where is your hope? So for myself, my hope is that if somehow I can, if Prabhupada becomes pleased with me and by his mercy, then maybe some good will come. And my part is to try my best to please Prabhupada. But that's, I guess that's my hope. So is that okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, I read recently that that humility is almost more or less the same as love for Krishna. It's an interesting concept. That the more we feel unqualified, but the more we sincerely try really our best, that's very attractive to Krishna. That attracts mercy. Just like the negative pole of a magnet will attract the positive. But not to be negative about yourself and think, I'm terrible, and all day long thinking about how bad you are, because that's not Krishna consciousness. That's got nothing to do with spiritual life. That's just neurosis. That's my conclusion. But when you understand that you're not very qualified, and then you take shelter of Krishna very quickly, that's humility.
Humble.
Huh? Yeah.
Humble.
Yeah, humble. Yes. And there's almost no difference between humility and love for Krishna, though. They're so intimately connected. Any other thoughts or questions? Yeah.
You mentioned the other religions that are supposed to bring to a certain realization. But which exactly level they actually can get if for basic stuff like vegetarianism they don't follow? I mean, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and most of the religions don't even have the basic concepts of religion according to the Vedic scriptures. So to which actual level of realization they can bring a person?
But their concept of what the goal is what I was talking about. Their goal will be one of those three, and it's generally not the person, God, the Supreme Person. It's generally something less, an impersonal concept generally. But as far as what level, if I answer the question the way you asked it, it will be sectarian. You know, our religion is better than your religion, you know, and then more fighting. But the way I see it is, and actually the way Prabhupada explained, that there's not actually many, many religions. There's one religion, and that's love for Krishna, love for God. So if someone really has love for God, then they really have love for God, regardless of what religious path they follow. But whether one can have love for God and be merciless towards God's children is another question. Merciless, not care about killing them. That's another question. That certainly isn't pleasing to the father if you kill the children. Why? Because you like the way they taste. So that, I mean, it's not that, it's horrible.
But then can they really come to a stage where they have a certain realization? I mean, isn't that supposed to block much of the possibilities?
Yeah, it will tend to, for sure. But then one will ask the question, is that really following the teachings of that religion? If they're not merciful. If you do unto others as you would have others do unto you. And then you kill them and eat them? Would you like it if someone was trying to kill you and eat you?
But most of them,
you didn't answer my question. Well, who would? No one would. So the question is, are they really following?
They say they are,
but what they say isn't always exactly the absolute truth. Are they really? If it says in the Bible, thou shalt not kill, and then they, and Prabhupada used to always say that, you're killing. Oh, but what it really means is murder, meaning just humans. You're allowed to kill any other creature you want, but you just can't kill humans? No. That's merciless. As if the animals don't feel pain and don't suffer. Have you ever seen an animal being killed? I traveled in from Los Angeles to San Francisco on Pacific One, that takes you through the desert. And in the middle of the desert, there was an abattoir slaughterhouse for cows. And they were in the middle of the desert because that, you put something like that in the middle of the desert because the animals are screaming all the time and crying out in terror, and I heard them. So, because they know what's going to happen. So, is that pleasing? Oh, that's because they don't have any souls. Oh, okay. There's no life in their bodies. That's a hypocrisy. So whether one can be a cruel hypocrite and be a lover of Krishna, of God, or whatever religion, I wouldn't think so. Like, you know, if you actually have love, your heart is soft and tender. Can you bear that, to do that to another? But never mind, because I don't want to bring it into, you know, this religion. But I'm just talking about the principles of practically almost common sense. So if you're in the desert and there's no food and you don't have a choice, then that's one thing. But if you can avoid that kind of cruelty, they should avoid it. I remember, do you remember when you became a vegetarian?
Yes.
Yeah, what, do you remember the effect of it?
Definitely, it made better feelings, better health. Maybe yes, maybe it was better.
Yeah, so I remember it very clearly, that it was like a cloud coming off of my consciousness.
That's right.
Yeah, and then I didn't know how to cook anything except rice, so it didn't work very well. So I started eating unmentionable things again, and I felt the cloud came right back. And after that, I learned how to cook. You remember when you became? Yeah. Did it have an effect on your consciousness?
Yeah,
noticeable.
Would have previously lived so much differently.
Yeah.
Immediately.
You can look in the eyes of the animals.
Yeah. As it, and then you can say they don't have life in them? How absurd. It's cruel. And if you're cruel, can you be which is your question, can you actually be a lover of advanced spiritually? And it's, you know, the two are contradictory, in fact. But, you know, again, bringing it off the point of this religion versus that religion, in Krishna consciousness, it's the same thing. If you're cruel and hard-hearted, it means that something's not right in your practice. Because the basic principle of Krishna consciousness too, but one of them is Jiva Doya, which means mercy towards all living entities. What is this? Who cooked these? Wow. Is this a sweet or?
No.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Would anyone like? It's just a little too late for me. Would anyone like an extra one of these?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Is there more? Sure.
This time in India, we just came back a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And it was the first time I was close to a calf, a young one. I never saw calf because I live in the city.
Yeah.
And for a long time before I became a vegetarian, I was avoiding looking at cows and chicken. I couldn't. And now I can get there are few years old, but I never had a chance to go near cows.
They're amazing. They're so innocent. So innocent.
And just holding them and looking at them, it's a really special.
And if you take it on the other side, to cause harm to them, how hard-hearted you have to be.
Most people are so brainwashed, they don't see that they see a difference between a little girl and a young cow.
Simple, and therefore there's so much suffering in the world. It's karma, reaction.
There's a little irony that the Bhagavad Gita is related as a way of warfare.
Perhaps not irony, but
it's the wrong word. I didn't think it was the right word.
Yeah, but I know what you mean. But yeah, paradoxical. Yeah, I think it's more like that. That I think it also shows that if you can practice spiritual life on a battlefield, no one has an excuse for their lives that I can't practice spiritual life because I'm doing this or doing that. But we also understand from the Bhagavad Gita that violence is unavoidable in this world.